environmentally sound for your mind. HRNradio.com.
Hi, everybody. Helping Yourself to Know-How is why you're here with Dr. Greer, and you're listening to the Doctor on Call Hour at HealthyLife.net. Well, it's hot, it's happening, it's sizzling. Yes, it is Let's Talk Sex time. Welcome to the show, everyone. It is a great one with authors Catherine Koss and Robert Green. Joining me now is my first guest, Catherine Koss. She's an experienced nutritional therapy practitioner with an MD, MED in rehabilitation counseling. Her focus is on helping women overcome emotional and hormonal imbalance, creating diet and fitness plans that lead to total wellness, and fostering healthy sleep and sexuality. After years of working with clients, Koss saw a need for more widespread information about the effects of perimenopause and consequently wrote 40s on Fire, Rediscover Your Sexuality, Learn to Honor Your Moods, and Thrive Throughout Your 40s and Beyond. I'm delighted to welcome you to the show today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with, why are the 40s such a difficult time for women? Does it start before then?
It can start as early as our mid-30s. We often hear about when women get PMS, right, when we're first kind of entering puberty, but then we don't hear about the transitional phase of perimenopause very often. We hear about menopause and the hot flashes, but we don't really hear too much about those years that lead up to it. Our hormones really begin to change, and it can happen as early as our mid-30s, and our moods start to change, and PMS can get worse. So it is a very turbulent transitional time for women.
And how do you recognize that? That makes a lot of sense, because with our bodies, usually all of a sudden there's, you know, you have a cold, but typically you're getting more run down, you're getting more tired, you're getting more stressed, and all of a sudden you have a cold. But it is progressive, just like what you're describing. How can a woman know if, in fact, more intense cramps with her period or more moodiness is to be attributed to perimenopause as opposed to just a bad period or a bad week or a bad, you know, upset at work? Like, how do you begin to ferret out, hey, maybe there's something going on?
Yeah, you probably notice a pattern after a time. So if it's happening every cycle, if your cycles are starting to be, if your periods are uneven, where you're having one at 26 days, one at 34 days, you start to notice cramping is more severe when you hadn't had it before. And a lot of times, just your moods can change at the drop of a hat. You'll go from being, you know, happy and everything's fine to just feeling like a lot of doom, a lot of darkness, a lot of sadness. And it can be really difficult to handle those emotions. Almost can feel pendulum-y, like you're swinging. That's a good sign that there might be some hormonal imbalance going on.
And what's the first, if you notice that, do you go, oh, no, I can't believe I'm in perimenopause, or is the first step to say, huh, I might be going through some hormonal changes. I better get to the doctor and see if, in fact, this is happening. Do you recommend getting the blood work to determine if this is happening?
Yes, I would recommend getting your hormone levels tested, definitely, because that definitely plays a role. I recommend also kind of taking a look at your diet, kind of taking a look at your stress levels and your sleep and all other areas of your life, because our hormones are impacted by so many things. So it could also just, you know, there's also a lot of environmental toxins that can raise estrogen and make you kind of more in an excessive estrogen. So there's a lot of different things that it could be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely good to get your hormone levels checked and try to kind of figure out what's going on. What's the root of this? What's the root cause?
Mm-hmm. And are there specific medications or supplements that you would encourage women to start to take once you go to the doctor, you do some blood work, and in fact you are going through some hormonal transitioning? Is there a course of action that is most helpful to intervene early to get some relief?
Yeah, so what I advocate for is a functional medicine approach, which is looking at the root cause as to what might be going on, and it's different for every female because we're also bio-individuals. So one person might have low testosterone, one person might have excess estrogen. And then I like to take a more natural approach, so definitely making dietary changes, excessive amounts of processed carbohydrates and sugars in the diet can really impact our hormonal health, so we take a look at nutrition, our stress levels, like I said earlier, that can throw our hormones out of balance. So it's a kind of a an approach that kind of looks at everything and kind of digs for the root cause. So the root would be, you know, first just figuring out what your hormone levels are and what's going on, what types of changes can we make. So it's definitely not just taking any specific medication. There are supplement recommendations. There are a lot of supplements that I would recommend, and I would also recommend seeing a functional medicine practitioner, a doctor trained to kind of look at the root cause.
So let me ask you this. Would it ever be indicated, like you were talking about diet and nutrition, without necessarily getting alarmed or concerned or worried that, you know, I'm only in my late 30s or early 40s and I think I'm getting ready to move into menopause? Can you sort of self-treat just by becoming more mindful and conscious of your diet and changing what you're eating, eliminating some of the carbs and the sugars and the things that can really wreak a little havoc with your hormones? Would that be a step to consider?
That's a huge step. In fact, I grew up in the generation where everyone feared fat, right? So it was low fat, fat-free everything. But fat is the building block to healthy hormones. It's just the right kinds of fat. So not fearing fat, I think when we were in the generation that was fearing fat, we were also making up for that low fat by increasing a lot of processed foods. And to make the foods taste better, we were adding a lot of sugar.
Mm.
So this has a profound impact on our cells. Our cells are mitochondria. And to have healthy hormones, we need to have healthy cells. So we need to get those healthy fats. So I would make recommendations simply by just working on increasing the amount of healthy fats that you're getting in your diet, decreasing processed foods, trying to stick to more real whole foods, can definitely make a huge impact.
So what are some healthy fats? Because you're absolutely right. That sounds like an oxymoron. You know, like you hear healthy fat and somebody saying, no, fat is fat and you don't want to eat fat and fat is not healthy, fat is unhealthy. What are healthy fats that women can actually eat, not only not fear, but consider something that they're doing to enhance and strengthen their health?
Yeah, so I'm all about coconut oil, avocado oil, olive oil, macadamia nut oils, and even animal fats from healthy animals that have been pasture-raised, seafood, wild-caught. Definitely really big on coconut oil and avocados and all of that, nuts and seeds.
So, but you're not talking cookies
No.
You know, macaroni, or in other words, some of the food that is fattening, that is enjoyable, but that has no redeeming qualities to it. You're talking the fats in the oils or the, you know, the fishes that.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
yes.
But do people have to cultivate? Do women have to cultivate a taste for those foods, because those are not, you know, typically it's Russian dressing or Thousand Island or, you know.
Right.
All the creamy ranch, all the creamy dressings, it's not,
right.
That's not their go-to.
Processed foods out there. And it would probably be best to work with a practitioner to get to know, you know, when I was working, you know, more one-on-one with clients, I would take a look at their diet and see what can be changed and see what can be swapped out for what. And there's a lot of ways to incorporate real food into a still tasty diet. It can be challenging, but you know, menu planning and sticking to recipes. There's so many great recipes out there now. And finding a support system, all of that can be really helpful.
So is becoming aware of your food, making conscious choices to eat more practically and healthy, going to the doctor, getting blood work, finding out what, you know, what's missing, what you can supplement with, is that what you would call the functional approach to hormonal health?
Yeah, so I would recommend looking for a functional medicine doctor or a nutritional therapy practitioner. These type of providers will take a look, will help you kind of determine, again, I use the word root cause, but what's going on in your body, your bio-individual body, that's causing the hormone imbalance rather than just taking a medication.
Mm-hmm.
So it's looking at your hormone levels, looking at your thyroid, looking at your lifestyle. How are you sleeping? how is your diet? What is your family life like? What is your structure at home? Where do you need more support?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of different factors that come into play. So in my book, I really advocate functional medicine providers because they look at your whole self. They look at everything and then they come up with a plan based on your needs, and it's dietary changes and supplement recommendations and even lifestyle recommendations.
So let me ask you this. You mentioned the thyroid, and that really sort of raises the flag, and it makes me wonder. The thyroid is the master gland. So many women, as they're going through aging, getting older, hormonal shifts and changes, their thyroids go out of whack. They go over, they go under, they go Hashimoto, both up and down. Would you ever encourage women, before you even start with your gynecologist and trying to get an index on what's happening hormonally, to just go get your thyroid tested?
Yes, and I also recommend to women, because a lot of doctors won't do this, is to do a full thyroid panel,
mm-hmm.
not just the TSH, but a full thyroid panel. Find out exactly. Sometimes you can have a normal TSH and still have undetected Hashimoto's, so get your thyroid antibodies checked.
Mm-hmm.
And markers for autoimmune thyroid. And also your T3, your reverse T3, all of the thyroid numbers versus just your TSH, which a lot of doctors typically don't go dig that deep when it comes to thyroid health, and you can get more answers as to what might be going on.
And that's such a terrific point. One of the women that I work with, in fact, was going through some of the symptoms and experiencing some of what we're talking about, and then decided to get her thyroid tested and went and had the basic generic thyroid TSH test done, and everything came back normal. And her moods continued to just ratchet, and her weight continued to, she just continued to gain, and she was more lethargic. And I mean, as she was telling me all the symptoms, I said, I don't care what you're saying. I don't care what the desk said. You're describing thyroid symptoms. You know, the hair, the loss of hair, and the dry skin, and the cold. Just all the symptoms that go with underactive thyroid and weight gain. That's sort of like the first thing you want to know about.
And if your thyroid's out of whack, it can throw all your other hormones out of whack as well. Like you said, it is a master gland, and there's a delicate stool. If there's a delicate hypothalamic, pituitary, adrenal, all of these different endocrine systems are all balanced out in this very delicate three-legged stool. So if your thyroid's out of whack, it's going to throw everything else out of whack. So when you're getting your hormone levels tested, I do recommend a thorough thyroid panel as well. It definitely will help give some answers as to what might be going on.
So could it also be just that simple, without having to overhaul your whole diet or worry and treat or go to, a holistic doctor, a functional practitioner, that you really can nip it in the bud by treating your thyroid if, in fact, it's over or under?
If it's over or under, typically there's an outside reason for that as well. So you still want to do that functional approach. A lot of people's thyroids are affected by toxins, by environmental toxins, things in our products that we're using, toxins in our products that we're using, and in our foods, our overprocessed foods. So you still want to make those holistic changes for your thyroid health.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Absolutely makes sense. So let's talk about the impact of all these hormonal changes on two really critical areas, sleeping and sexuality. Let's start with sleeping. What disrupts women's sleep? Is it hormonal for women who can't sleep? Is it just anxiety? What do you suggest or recommend?
Usually if there is anxiety, there's something going on, again, deeper that we could probably dig into to find out the cause of the anxiety. And yes, hormones can impact our sleep as well. We have a circadian rhythm, an internal rhythm. Our cells respond to this rhythm all the way down to our microbiome. Our microbiome, our gut bacteria has a rhythm, has a nocturnal and a diurnal rhythm. So we have these sleep cycles that are very wired into our every being. And when we live in a culture that's so incredibly stressed and rushed and busy and eating fast and eating on the go and being in artificially lit environments, all of this can play into that very delicate circadian rhythm that we have. So sleep should be top priority, right? You can't really function without sleep. But sleep is the one thing that most people put on the back burner and completely avoid. We kind of, you know, we stay up late on our screens. We just don't value sleep as much in our culture, and it is a huge area that can really impact our hormonal health and our sex drive. So some simple things that I recommend are to pay attention to your sleep, pay attention to your sleep cycle. If you can get out in the morning and get early sunlight on your face, that can help set the hormone melatonin to produce enough melatonin at night. So getting sunlight during the day helps you sleep better at night. So in the wintertime, that's tough, right, because you don't want to be out there. I recommend those light therapy lamps if you're working. And getting that light on your skin so that your whole body can kind of respond to that and produce enough melatonin to sleep deeper at night. That's one thing. Also, wearing blue light blocking glasses if you're on screens 2 hours before bed. Just really valuing your sleep and making it a priority.
And do you find that there are different obstacles to sleeping? That there are women, I mean, I know I talk with both men and women who describe falling asleep is the problem, and or they fall asleep, but they wake up and they can't stay asleep. So for some people, they're up in the, you know, like 4 or 5 in the morning, and then that's it. Once they're up, they're up. Does the sleep disruption, the differences in the sleep disruption, matter, and is that connected to hormones?
Yes, it is connected to hormones. It's very much connected to cortisol. If our cortisol is filled out when we have excessive stress, and if our cortisol levels raise in the evening when they're supposed to be lowering so we can sleep better, then that's going to throw our whole sleep rhythm off, and that's those nighttime waking. So in order to help balance out your cortisol, it's taking a look at where you can work on lifestyle areas of stress reduction. And also I recommend herbal adaptogens. They're herbs that can help with lowering your cortisol levels and helping your body to, your adrenals, to handle the stress of modern living. Our adrenals are taxed. A lot of women have adrenals that are pretty burnt out from producing excessive amounts of cortisol. So finding ways to support your adrenals, finding ways to support your levels of stress can make a huge impact. And again, that's just taking the time to really think about your sleep and how important it is and how can you fix it and how can you prioritize it as well.
Right. And so becoming aware can help you exercise some control so that you don't wind up feeling out of control waking up in the middle of the night. We're going to take control by going to a break right now, so stay with us. We'll be back in a minute at the Let's Talk Sex Show here at HealthyLife.net.
Lighting the way with positive energy and love, HRNRadio.com.
Welcome back to the Let's Talk Sex Show at HealthyLife.net. My guest is author Catherine Koth. You can find more from her on LinkedIn at linkedin.com/in/CatherineKothNTP or her website, www.primalmusings.com. So, all right, we've been talking about hormones and how they can wreak havoc with stress, with mood, with health. Now let's talk about with sex, because this is Let's Talk Sex. So when you're dealing with all this hormonal upheaval, ups and downs and imbalance, how does it impact your libido, your sexuality, and the way that you express it?
Yeah, so if our hormones are out of balance and we're experiencing a state of excessive estrogen or low testosterone or any other combination of hormones that are out of balance, this can decrease our sex drive. So this can kind of impact our want for it and our desire for it, and also can just leave us feeling kind of low. So our sexual energy is our life force. I like to call it our life force energy, our passion. So that spills out into all the areas of our life. So if our sex drive is low, this can also impact our passion for other areas of our life, our career, our goals, our relationships with people. So we think that it's just low libido, but it actually can impact, you know, a lot of other areas of our life as well.
That's really interesting. Well, certainly, if your libido diminishes, it can make you feel like there's something wrong with you, right? You know, if you're not, if you don't have desire and your partner is looking to be amorous and you're just not interested, it can leave your partner really feeling rejected and worried that you've lost your attraction to them. It can leave you saying, well, what's wrong with me? How come I don't have any desire? How much of that is just, you know, the day-to-day intensity of juggling?
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, all of life.
We tend to put it on the back burner. We put our sexuality on the back burner. We kind of ignore it because there's so many other things we're focusing our energy on, children and mortgages and careers, and there's a lot of expectation on middle-aged women now to just be everything and do everything and to have that climbing career and to have that family and to, you know, meet all these goals and expectations. And so our sexuality just tends to get pushed onto the back burner, and it's something that we just really don't, you know, we kind of just put that off. But it's also something that if it's not nourished, then it will die. So we want to nourish it. We need to make, again, just like sleep, it's something that we need to make a bigger priority. And when we do, when we take that time to make time for it, all the other areas of our life can flourish as well. Because, again, we're utilizing that sexual energy into all the areas of our life. And it spills out into our passions and the things that excite us and kind of fire us up.
So what are some good ways for women who are juggling a million things, kids, work, husband, you know, food shopping, dinner, lunch, you name it,
right,
to get in touch with their sexuality and or to accept that maybe they're not feeling as sexy as they did before they were doing so much, but to try and reclaim some piece of their sensual self?
Yeah, so again, just having that awareness is the first thing. Like, I need to nourish this. This can't die. This is part of my essence. It's part of my femininity. It's part of who I am, and I can't let that just die out on me. So again, figuring out what might be going on hormonally, like we talked about earlier, is one big step, prioritizing our sleep, and also just making the time for it. So if you're in a relationship, making that time to connect in that way every single day, making that, you know, making the time for sex rather than scheduling it in, just having it, that maybe you have to have it, like have a set time that works best for both of you, and just by nurturing it, it will grow. By not letting it kind of die out, it will grow. And even if you're not partnered, you can still nurture your sexuality and your sensuality through things that fire you up and taking the time to make those types of parts of your life a priority, and maybe putting some of the other stuff that we feel needs to be a priority on the back burner.
Well, you know, I like what you're saying very much, because I think people very often just think that they're going to have sex the way they did when they were first involved and getting to know each other and in the free fall of love and relationship, and that you just fall into bed and everything else isn't as important as being together. There's no question that at the beginning of a relationship, the other person, being with that person, is your priority. And I like to call it scheduled spontaneity, because I hear a lot of couples saying, oh, but it takes all the, you know, the spontaneity out of it if we have to schedule it, and it's too thought about. And I often say, well, yeah, you have to think about it. It's like planning to go out to dinner at a restaurant. You have to think about it, make a reservation, or you're not going to have any dinner. And the same thing is true with sex. You know, in this day and age, you have to think about it, and you have to say, you know what, I want to have a nice night, not out at a restaurant, but in bed with my honey, and make it a plan to schedule it. Now, in that time, you can spontaneously approach and initiate and be involved with one another, but just like what you're saying.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you.
Right. You've got to plan that. You've got to put it into place. And isn't that a way, if you're doing that, isn't that a way that women can really exercise responsibility and, you know, express their sexuality in a healthy way?
Yes, absolutely. It's a great way to express your sexuality and not feel guilty for prioritizing that, right? Because we feel like, well, I should be doing this instead. Well, I should be doing this. And we've got all these lists going through our brain, and, you know, we have all this pressure on us. If you start to make that your priority, it's going to show through in all the other areas of your life. Because, again, it's that sexual energy that gives you the drive for everything else that, that excites you in your life. And it's just going to roll into all of these other things and make everything else go so much smoother. So I think it's taking away the guilt factor of I'm making the time for this, but I should be taking away the I should and I need to's and the and focusing on what's important in the moment.
Terrific. And before we run out of time, you've written about grounding. Talk about grounding and what it is and why it's so important.
So grounding is actually being barefoot out in nature, getting in touch with the earth. And the earth has an electromagnetic field. It has a negative charge to it. So it can really help put your body into a parasympathetic or relaxed state. So if you're feeling stressed, if you're feeling anxious, if your hormones are out of balance, any of these things, just by getting in contact with the earth, even for a few minutes each day, can help to ground you. And kind of, it sounds a little probably flighty to some people to hear that, but there's a lot of scientific evidence and studies that back up grounding as a great method for decreasing cortisol levels and sleeping better at night, for having more energy throughout the day, for being in a more relaxed state. So anytime you're feeling stressed, overwhelmed, fatigued, you're struggling with your thyroid health, there's one recent study that showed one night of sleeping on the earth, which I know is not doable for everyone, especially upstate New York in the wintertime,
right.
But actually lowered the excessive thyroid hormone. It balanced out thyroid levels. So there's a lot to be said about going back to our ancestral health and what our ancestors did. So if if you can't be out in the wintertime, in the middle of winter, stepping on snow, there's actually grounding mats available that you can purchase that kind of give off a similar negative ionic charge to help relax you.
Well, it sounds terrific, and I want to thank you so much for being here and sharing such helpful, illuminating wisdom in terms of what women can do to take care of their bodies, take care of their sexuality, and take care of themselves. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And listeners, be sure to follow Catherine Koss on LinkedIn or at her website, www.primalmusings.com. When we come back, stay with us because author Robert Green will be joining us. You're listening to the Let's Talk Sex Show at HealthyLife.net. And remember, send your questions on love and relationships to me at AskDrJane at DrJaneGreer.com, and I'll answer them on the show. Back in a minute.
HRNradio.com, where positive people and podcasts unite.
Welcome back to the Let's Talk Sex Show. I'm Dr. Jane Greer. My next guest is Robert Green. Robert Green is an American author and speaker known for his books on strategy, power, and seduction. He's written 5 international bestsellers, The 48 Laws of Power, The Art of Seduction, The 33 Strategies of War, The 50th Law, and Mastery. In his book, The Art of Seduction, he asks the reader, which sort of seducer could you be? Siren, rake, cold coquette, star, comedian, charismatic, or saint? Charm, persuasion, the ability to create illusions? When raised to the level of art, seduction, an indirect and subtle form of power, has toppled empires, won elections, and enslaved great minds. In this beautifully sensually designed book, Green unearthed the 2 sides of seduction, the characters and the process. And thank you for joining us here on the show to talk about it.
Thank you for having me, Jane. My pleasure.
So what do you think are the 3 foundations of seduction? And do you think that seduction is used mostly for negative purposes in today's culture?
Well, for seduction, I mean, the main skill that you must have is the ability to get inside the mind and the spirit of the other person, to individualize your attention.
Mm-hmm.
So there are seducers in this world who are very mechanical, who've read books about pickup artists or something, and they apply certain strategies to whomever they meet. And the man or the woman who's the target of this, they can sense that they're being strategic, that it has nothing to do with them, that they're just sort of interested in seduction itself. And it's not very effective. And what is effective is to give the other person the sense that you understand what their life, their spirit, their way of thinking, what they're missing in life, what gives them pleasure. And to do that, you have to have the unique ability to get outside of yourself and inside the skin of the other person. The other thing is seduction has to be, is an art that deals with pleasure. If you're giving the other person a kind of pleasant feeling, whether it's through flattery, whether it's through the constant attention you're giving them. And so, you know, you have to have a somewhat light spirit about it. If the other person isn't responding, you don't get all negative and defensive. You know, you try and see what they're thinking and what you're doing wrong. And so having a sort of a light spirit about it, not taking things personally, and being able to get inside the mindset of other people, those are sort of the critical basis, foundations for being a good seducer. Now, in our culture today, you know, there's a lot of news about sexual harassment and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But seduction has nothing whatsoever to do with harassment. It's quite the opposite. I maintain in the book that normally we go through life rather closed to other people. Increasingly, as we get older, we become more and more defensive, locked in our own worlds. And seduction is a kind of vulnerability that you had as a child. You're opening yourself up to another person. You're letting them enter your mind space. And in that sense, I find it a very positive, a very sort of therapeutic effect, particularly in an age when so many people are so narcissistic and can't get outside of their own little bubble. So the way I define seduction has absolutely nothing to do with any kind of harassment. And I make it very clear in the book that I'm treating equally men and women. I maintain that seduction is an art that women created to sort of equal a power struggle historically, and then men sort of co-opted this power. But I include in the book stories, equal amount of stories about women seducing men and men seducing women. I also have stories about gay seductions, even transgender seduction. So it crosses all boundaries, and the way I define it, I don't find any connection whatsoever to any kind of harassment or violence.
Mm-hmm. So what's the goal of seduction? You know, in listening to you, seduction sounds very much like the sexualized, encapsulated version of a good business pitch. You know, that you've got a great product and you want to sell it and you want to get inside the other person's mind to make them, you know, to figure out why they're going to need this and why this is going to be something useful to them so that they will buy what you are selling. And the difference being that you're not selling a product, you're essentially selling yourself. So what's the goal?
Well, I wouldn't quite put it in such mercenary terms. I don't see it as a business transaction. I don't think you're implying that. But the goal is to make the other person fall in love with you. The goal is to have a psychological effect on them so that
selling yourself, then. I mean, essentially,
what?
Essentially, you are looking to sell yourself to them if you want to make them feel good about you and fall for you. Then you are selling yourself to the person. You're looking to seduce them by making them feel good about you. You're selling yourself, in a sense.
But you're also making them feel good about themselves as well. In fact, that's actually more important. I have the quote in there about Benjamin Disraeli, the Prime Minister of England in the 19th century, who was one of the great social seducers in history. And his great rival was a man named, Goldsmith. And this woman said, after sitting next to Mr. Goldsmith at a party, I thought he was the most charming, intelligent person in the world. But after sitting next to Mr. Disraeli, I thought that I was the most charming, intelligent person in the world.
Mm.
The seducer knows how to put the attention on the other person. So it's not about me. It's not about me selling myself. It's about making the other person get the validation and the recognition and the sense of and the kind of attention that they want, the quality of attention that they want. And look how rarely we ever get that in the world. I mean, a lot of people, you know, couples will complain about after the initial romance, the other partner tends to ignore them. That's a typical complaint that women have with men. And how little in life, even in work or wherever, do we get a sense that people recognize us as an individual and, you know, our worth as an individual. So the ability to give people that sensation is incredibly powerful. So the attention must be on the other person, not
mm-hmm.
on you, and that
mm-hmm.
is what will make a good seducer.
Mm-hmm. So, but again, what's the goal? To make them feel good to what end?
Well, okay. Well, the goal, I mean, you know, the goal is a seduction, is to make the person fall under your spell. Purpose?
Yes.
You're asking me for what purpose?
Right. To what end?
Depends on you. If you want marriage, you can get somebody to fall in love with you and get married. If you want, you know, if you're younger and you want to just have some fun, it's to get the other person, you know, to get your hooks in them, to get them to be interested in you, to get them to like you. If you're a president or a politician, it's to get people to vote for you. If you're a business person, it's the soft sell, to get people to buy your product. Depends on who you are and what your goals are. But the main thing is to create a spell and to make people think of you when you're not there.
Right. So to me, I have to say, honestly, when it all comes around, it is a matter of seducing the other person to engage them so that you get from them what you want, whether it's to have a relationship or to make a business deal or to get them to vote for you or to get them to like you or whatever it is. It is a skill to enhance their well-being, flattering them, reeling them in, making them feel good about themselves, that they're going to like you. And if you, I mean, and even if that's just the end game, that you just want to be liked, well, it's still all about your self-esteem. Anyway, stay with us. We'll be back in the Art of Seduction at the Let's Talk Sex Show in just a minute at HealthyLife.net.
Uplifting Talk, HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to the Let's Talk Sex Show at HealthyLife.net. My guest is author Robert Green, and he is the author of The Art of Seduction. You can find more from him on http://powerseductionandwar.com. We were talking during the break about the end game, the goal of seduction, and I think you made a really important distinction that seduction is transactional. It's not just one person being seductive, but if the seduction is working, then it's coming back at you. It's two people being seductive with one another.
Yeah, I mean, in order to be able to seduce the other person, you have to first have sort of fallen under their spell, fall in love with them. Otherwise, you know, it'll seem fake. It will seem like you are one of those cold, mechanical seducers. So if you have fallen under their spell, if you're in love with them, if you find them exciting and enticing or whatever, then you're going to be able to show it through your actions, through your nonverbal behavior, and you'll have a much greater effect. So if you're just going around trying to get, if it's all about you and getting people interested in you, I think nowadays particularly women are very sophisticated, and they can see through that kind of strategy and that kind of coldness.
Right. And so there really are two sides of seduction, then.
Yes, I believe so. I mean, the greatest novel about seduction is Dangerous Liaison. It's an amazing novel. I quote it extensively in my book. And the main character is this incredible seducer, Valmont.
Oh, yes.
He's probably the most brilliant strategic seducer. And then but he's bored with it because it's become too easy for him. And at the point of the novel, he falls in love with this woman. He decides he's going to seduce them. So he's going to seduce this very prudish woman who would be the last person to ever fall for him. But the point of the novel is that he finds himself actually falling in love with her. And he kind of drops all of his strategies and he falls under her spell. And then in that process, she begins to fall for him. And I take that as kind of a paradigm for what I'm discussing in the book. You have to first be under the spell of the other person in order to be able to draw them out of their own defenses.
Which is exactly what happens very often. It's not the case that two people meet each other and fall in love with each other concomitantly. More often than not, one person is significantly more smitten and the other person is more reserved. And
yeah.
Exactly what you're describing, they become the seducer, the pursuer, if you will, to engage the other person, right?
Exactly. Yes, I agree.
That's what you're describing. And can you actually seduce yourself through hypnosis or by repeating a mantra on a day-to-day basis? Would you call that seduction?
I don't know. I don't know. For what purpose? What are you doing that for?
I don't know. In other words, the principles of seduction vary depending if you're applying it to an individual or to a large group. But can you actually apply it to yourself, to seduce yourself, if you will, into some positive behavior?
Well, I suppose you could. I mean, I have a part of the book. I talk about the anti-seducer. I talk about the qualities that are very anti-seductive to human nature. Things like being extremely ungenerous with your money or your time. Seducers are very generous and very open and very liberal with money and time. Or being kind of brutish and forceful. I have, you know, maybe 10 or 12 such anti-seductive traits. And one of the main goals is to root that out of yourself. And a lot of people write to me saying, I'm so frightened, I find that I have these traits.
Mm.
And I believe, yes, through some form of self-therapy, maybe even through to hypnosis, even maybe just through looking at yourself deeply, you can root out some of these qualities and, you know, maybe like yourself more. I don't know if that's... If the goal of what you're talking about is to seduce you, is to like yourself more, yeah, of course that's possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like seduction is about charm. You know, seduction is about being charming, making somebody else feel charming, and engaging in a charming way with them so that it's a feel-good for everybody. And, you know, if you can do that with yourself, if you, in a sense, can charm yourself into feeling good about yourself or better about yourself, then, you know, it becomes a very powerful skill, a very powerful skill.
Yeah, I think what a lot of people are missing now today is a sense of kind of a theater of being drawn out of themselves, of being taken out of their humdrum lives, out of their routine, and drawn into a world that's more heightened and more pleasurable and more fun. I think it's something that's very much missing. And that is sort of the art of seduction, is to create these kind of theatrical effects. It's almost sort of like a mythic type quality. And I want to tell readers, even in this very modern world, where people are so sophisticated with their technology, etc., these kind of mythic, ancient, unconscious processes that are so deeply embedded in humans are still very much alive. And we all want to be taken outside of ourselves. We all want to be drawn out of our own little world and be led into something exciting and different. It's what makes us watch a movie, for instance,
mm-hmm.
where we don't know what's going to happen next and we're drawn into another world that a great artist has created. I mean, it's not as obviously as grandiose as that, but on some level, that's what a good seducer is doing.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, without a doubt, the art of seduction is really a skill to practice because you have to get outside yourself. And you know, and nowadays most people are focused on themselves or inside themselves, and really shine your light on somebody else so that they can feel their own light. And from that, then hopefully, from what you're describing, it sounds like then you both ignite together.
Yeah, I think very well put. I couldn't have said it better.
Thank you so much. But you know, the thing about it is, and you said it earlier, you know, in today's Me Too and you know, all the sexual harassment going on, and in the era of narcissists and sociopaths, you do have to be careful, because sometimes...
Oh, definitely.
Right? This is...
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And, you know, it's interesting because a lot of readers of my book, particularly women, have said that the book helped them very much identify that a man was practicing certain kind of seductive tactics on them, and they were able to get some distance from them. I'm talking more about kind of that cold seducer type that I mentioned earlier,
mm-hmm.
who's sort of read certain principles from a book or whomever, or who is kind of sociopathic. And they said the book has helped them kind of identify what's going on, the process, and to get some emotional distance from these people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Because, you know, I wrote a book called How Could You Do This to Me? Learning to Trust After Betrayal. And basically, the different personalities that I describe, I took the pathology right out of the diagnostic manual code. And, you know, so for sociopaths and psychopaths, I called them users, because that made it a user-friendly handle for people. But they're basically, they're exercising the skill of seduction, but in the extreme, and not from what you were describing, which is so distinctive and makes it the, you know, the core of it, not in a transactional way, not in the interactive for the both of us to feel similarly, but gain control or gain entry into the other person's psyche to control. And
I certainly don't want to deny that that happens, and that's quite frequently, and it's certainly more frequently with men, although there are women who are capable of being extremely manipulative with seduction as well.
Oh, absolutely.
but more often than not, it is men. And yet that is the side of seduction. I don't deny it.
Right.
That would be ridiculous.
Right.
But it's, to me, that's not sort of the point of my book and the kind of the ideas that I'm trying to promulgate. I'm trying to return to a concept of seduction that was more sort of mutually pleasurable.
Right.
Because I think in matters of romance, it is kind of like a ritual. It is sort of like a mating ritual. If you watch animals or you know, I was just recently in Mexico and I was watching some of their folkloric dances, and they reminded me of kind of mating rituals and sort of very more basic ideas of men and women kind of courting each other and fitting in a ritual and getting the other person.
Well, we want to hear more about it, but it is to say that it's very distinct. Okay. It's very distinctive and helpful for everybody to have heard and learned about seduction being mutually pleasurable in today's world. We want people thinking about one another. And thank you so much for such an insightful conversation and joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Dr. Greer. I really appreciate it.
You are very welcome. And that is it for today. Join me next month for a new episode of Dr. On Call featuring Shrink Wrap On Call. My guests are going to be Vince August. He's known as the Joking Judge. You don't want to miss this show. He is a character. He opens for The Daily Show as the comedian there. And he is a judge. And Maximo Sorrentino, he is fantastic. He is from the Jersey Shore family and is an actor and talent in his own right. You want to be there to hear the show. And stay in touch with me off the air at my Facebook page and on Twitter at Dr. Jane Greer. Remember, send your questions on love and relationships to me at AskDrJane@DrJaneGreer.com so I can answer them on the show. And thank you for listening, everyone. Remember, you can always get what you want when you're in the know.